L 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Professor Wade Pittard, who is the director of the Spurlock Museum. Now, Wade, the Spurlock Museum has had different names over its long 100-year history. Tell us some of those names and how it came to become the Spurlock Museum.
Well, the Spurlock Museum has been the Spurlock Museum for about a decade now, but our ancestor museums go back all the way to 1911. We're celebrating our centennial this year. And the first museums that come under the umbrella of today's Spurlock were a museum of classical archaeology and art and a museum of European cultures that were founded in 1911 as the idea of President Edmund James of the university. To those two were added an Oriental Museum in 1917. Oriental at that time meant ancient Near East, ancient Mesopotamia, the sort of the biblical lands. That one merged with the Classical Museum in 1929. The Classical and European Cultures Museums merged in 1962 into the Museum of Classical and European Cultures. But in 1971, because the university decided that the museum ought to focus on a larger part of the world than simply European culture, the museum was renamed the World Heritage Museum. And it remained the World Heritage Museum and slowly but surely became a museum of world cultures over the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And the director of the museum in the 80s, Barbara Bowen, got permission to begin searching for donors who might give us money to build a separate building for the museums. For 89 years, we were in the on the fourth floor of Lincoln Hall. And William Spurlock, an alumnus from the 1930s, came forward with a donation, a bequest, that allowed us to build a building. And so we are now the Spurlock Museum, and we are located due east of the Kranert Center for the Performing Arts at the corner of Oregon and Gregory Street.
And that's here in Urbana at the campus of the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Now, you've been the director of the Spurlock Museum for a while, but not the whole 100 years, of course. But tell us about your career before that here at the university. You came here as part of the program of the study of religion.
That's
and correct. Your specialty is?
I'm a professor of Hebrew Bible and ancient Near Eastern religions in the Department of Religion here. I arrived here in 1983. And have been happy to be here my entire career.
And it was fairly early in your career. You were named a university scholar, which is quite a distinguishing mark here at this campus.
Yeah, I felt really good about that. And this is an extraordinarily supportive place for the humanities. And every chance that I've taken to ask for funding to do strange projects, the university here has been very supportive.
Now, you yourself were chair of the Religious Studies program, which has now become a department and now is even offering a master's degree.
That's right.
You were chair for, what, about 3 years?
3 years.
Uh-huh. And what made you change from that and the kind of archaeology you were doing to be willing to be director of this fascinating museum? This museum does have a lot of religious artifacts, which we're going to be talking about, but was that the main draw?
I've been involved off and on with the museum since I arrived in 1983. There are a number of things that are connected in one way or another to biblical studies or to the ancient Near East. So I have been involved off and on from the early 80s. I got involved in a project to photograph using some very spiffy new cameras the museum's collection of ancient Mesopotamian cylinder seals that we might talk about a little bit. This was something that got me very much involved in 2007 at the museum, so that when Douglas Brewer, who was our previous director, was going on sabbatical, he asked if I'd be interested in taking over as acting director while he was gone. And I thought, oh, that'll be very nice because I'm already over here a lot connected to my project. And then he got offered another job at the university as director of continuing education in December of 2007. And so I wound up being in the right place at the right time, and I was offered the permanent position, and I've been very happy. I had liked the museum a lot before, having been there now for 3 years. I love the museum.
Let's jump right in and talk about some of these religious artifacts that can be found in the Spurlock Museum. And why don't we begin with the cylinder seals? Now, these are not animals.
That's correct.
Describe what a cylinder seal looks like.
Cylinder seals are small stone cylinders. They're sort of like very skinny spools for thread. They're about the same size as a small spool for thread. They're about an inch tall. They are carved. They're made out of stone, but they are carved with intricate designs around the cylinder.
Now, what period are we talking about?
And these were very important artifacts being used daily by people in ancient Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq, from about 3400 BCE to about 500 BCE. So for about 3,000 years, they developed at the same time writing developed.
Some of these are 5,000 years old.
That's correct.
It could be seen in this museum.
That's right.
Here in Urbana.
That's right.
Yeah.
And they were basically used by people who had documents that they were responsible for, administrative documents saying that so many sheep had come into the temple or the palace, so many sheep had gone out. They were basically one's signature. You would roll the seal across the wet clay of the tablet that you were writing on, the information about your contract or whatever was going on, and it acted as your signature.
So these were small enough to be carried easily.
That's right. They had hole drilled through the center of them, just like a spool for thread, and you could actually put string through it and wear it as a necklace, and people did. It was a piece of jewelry. It was also an amulet, because many of them had gods carved on them, and then it was your official signature as well. So, because each one had to be unique, because it was a single person's signature. The artisans who made these things had to be very clever, and this became one of the great art forms of ancient Mesopotamia. But they tell us a lot about economic things, tell us a lot about political things, because the king sometimes shows up as a character on these seals. But they also tell us a lot about religion, because the gods show up on these seals quite a bit. And they tell us about the gods that were understood to be most closely related to people. They tell us about the political uses of the gods. Certain gods appear on cylinder seals when certain cities are powerful, and then they disappear from seals when they are not powerful.
How could you tell the age?
We actually are able to date a lot of the seals because the seals were rolled. The motifs were fairly standard during a single period. So we have a lot of these seals rolled on clay tablets, and so we know what periods particular motifs were popular. And so then you can look at seals for which you don't have clay tablets with impressions, and say, oh yeah, this comes from that general period as well.
We're talking with Wayne Pittard, who's the director of the Spurlock Museum. And on Keeping the Faith Always, this is a call-in show, and we're eager to have listeners make comments or ask questions. The phone numbers, if you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. If it's long distance, and even if you're listening on the internet, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455. Our technical director, Kyle Crow, will answer the phone and get you in line to talk with our guest today, Wayne Pittard. Wayne, these signature cylinder seals that people would wear and use on clay documents are really hard to appreciate in most museums. But what is Spurlock doing? You showed me in a wonderful tour you gave me last week what you're doing to make these very readable and very attractive.
This is a problem. The seals are about an inch tall, which means that the characters on them are less than an inch tall. And if you want to see any kind of detail on them, well, it's very hard to do. Also, they're on cylinders, so you can only see about a third of the design that's carved on the whole thing, and that makes it also difficult. You can roll on a new piece of clay an impression of the seal, and we've done that, and you can see an impression. But even so, it's still only about an inch tall, and these things are so delicately carved that you really miss a lot. A colleague of mine at the University of Southern California, Bruce Zuckerman, is the director of a project called the West Semitic Research Project. I've been involved with that project for the last 30 years. Bruce, working with several companies, have developed a number of new camera systems that allow us to look at cylinder seals and their impressions in brand new ways. So the Spurlock now has a camera developed by Bruce and a group called Better Light that allows us to take high-resolution photographs of the cylindrical surface of the seal so that we can take beautiful pictures of the circular surface, but now the pictures look flat so that you can see the entire design, and you can enlarge them enormously and see every detail that the artisan has placed on these things. And the details are sometimes just absolutely astonishing. So the museum is in the process right now of creating a brand new exhibit that will take advantage of these new photographs. and so that people will be able to appreciate the artistic masterpieces that these tiny little seals are. And I think people will really enjoy that.
Now, tell us about some of the gods that were represented on these seals back in Mesopotamia, what we call modern Iraq, 5,000 years ago.
The most popular god on all of these seals is the sun god. The sun god was extremely important. The sun god was the god of justice, because the sun looked down upon the world and could see the evils that people did. So he was the one that made sure that justice prevailed. He was also the god of the netherworld, a god of the netherworld, an important god, because he was the one that every night journeyed down into the netherworld to go under the earth so that he could come back out on the east side of the world and march across the sky again. So he was the one that took the spirits of the dead down to the netherworld. So he plays a very important part in both areas. The appearance of Shamash, the sun god, or Utu, as he was called in the old Sumerian days of the third millennium BCE, the appearance on the seals is usually the time when he is just coming up between two mountains that basically hold up the sky. He comes out from the netherworld between these two mountains to move from east to west across the sky. And that morning time is an important symbol of hope and light and life. And today
on our television sets, there are some channels that show us sunrise every morning.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Sunrise for over 5,000 years has played that kind of role. And so it's not too surprising that the sun god would be an important figure on the cylinder seals.
And you learn about these gods as they're represented on these seals, but also in written language, right?
And that's right.
Now, what languages do you have? Of course, Hebrew is your main specialty, but...
Yeah, my major work has been in a Canaanite dialect closely related to Hebrew called Ugaritic. And most of my work has focused on a collection of Ugaritic religious documents, epic poems about the gods that are very closely related to Israel's God, gods like Baal, biblical Baal, Anat and the sun god and the moon god.
And so what period would those gods been prominent?
Yeah, those tablets date to about 1200 BCE, right at the time that Israel was first coming into existence as a nation. And the big surprising thing about those tablets is that it turns out that one of the major gods of the Canaanites is a god named El. And the god of Israel is also referred to as El. And in fact, it becomes very clear when you read the Ugaritic tablets that the Canaanite god El, who was the king of the gods and the creator of the world, is Israel's God, and sort of is the prehistory of Israel's God. So very, very interesting.
Well, now we're going to get into some subjects that may call for some comment from our listeners. Let me give our phone numbers again, 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois listening area. If you're farther away and it's a long-distance call, you may use our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We're talking with Wayne Pitard, a professor of religion and a university scholar and director of the Spurlock Museum here on the Urbana campus. Wayne, let's follow up a little bit on something controversial. People who just are sort of casually acquainted with your fields may know about some of the controversy about whether some of the biblical material from 1,000 years before the Common Era is historical or not. Taking over of the land of Cana, whether David and Solomon were actually historic beings or figures from saga, legend. What do you think? Huge question.
It is a huge question. The people who argue that everything basically in the historical books is a literary invention of the Persian period or later are simply wrong. I think that actual history of the Israelite nation does begin to show up in the writings about David and Solomon. I do think that they are historic characters. What is told about them is not fully historic material by any means. But there is no reason. I don't believe there's any reason to doubt that they existed, to doubt that they created a small empire. The thing that's important to understand is that while the Bible thinks of the empire of David and Solomon as this gigantic thing,
huge, yes.
Actually, when you pay attention to its size,
the numbers,
it's not much larger than
the geography
than New Hampshire and Vermont.
Okay,
it's really quite small.
Uh-huh.
But it's big for from their perspective, it's very big.
Of course.
And there's no reason to doubt that there was an actual empire. Once you go past earlier than David, you are getting into areas where there are old oral traditions that are being preserved in these things. For example, Genesis, the stories of Genesis, none of which you can take straightforwardly as historical accounts, they preserve the tradition that the God that the ancestors worshipped was not known by the divine name of Yahweh, but was known by the name of El. And that's probably not made up. Since we now know that the king of the gods in Canaanite mythology was El, and that El in Canaanite mythology was basically the same kind of character that he's portrayed as in the stories of the patriarchs and matriarchs in Genesis.
Now wait, if there were Canaanites alive today, would they refer to biblical mythology?
I don't know what word they would use for mythology. These are stories that are designed to explain the relationship between God and humans.
Sure.
And in the same way that Jesus uses parables to try to do that, that's what ancient Israelites did as well. They had these very old stories. They adapted them to say to their children, here is what you need to understand about the relationship between God and us. And that's what those stories were for.
Now, you yourself have done archaeology in the Near East, in the Holy Lands. Tell us a little bit about that experience for you.
It's a wonderful experience. I haven't been on an archaeological excavation in a long time, but early in my career, it changed the way I understood the realities of biblical Israel. By going on an excavation, by getting a sense of what archaeology can and cannot do, but by becoming familiar with the actual living remains of an ancient society, it just opens your eyes in ways that just really change your understanding of the Bible.
Now, for people who've not had the good fortune of traveling to some of these places that have such an ancient history, tell us what some of the things that you can actually see, outlines of buildings, the foundations at least.
For the biblical period, you can find remains of people's houses. You can walk through the streets of say Beersheba from the 9th century BCE, the time of shortly after the division of Northern Kingdom of Israel from Judah. You can walk through city gates at Gezer and Megiddo and Hazor that may come from the time of King Solomon. These are the foundations. That's what's generally left, but it's really quite it changes your understanding of things. It reading the Bible now with its miracle stories and such often makes it seem like a fantasy land, but it wasn't. It was a real place. And being over there and spending time, particularly if you have time to actually work on an archaeological site, it does change you.
Of course, people are familiar with some of the huge structures that have survived, like pyramids and Petra and things like that. But there is something to be gained just from fragments, isn't there?
That's right. Israel did not produce great architecture. It didn't produce great art. It produced great literature.
Uh-huh.
But what architecture and art there is still just quite extraordinary, even if it doesn't have quite the ring of the pyramids and such.
We're talking with Wayne Pittard, director of the Spurlock Museum at the University of Illinois, which is celebrating its 100 years from its founding this year. And we'll be asking Wayne more about the museum in just a moment. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. We're about halfway through our interview today with Professor Pittard. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM, and heard also at 90.9 FM HD3 if you have an HD3 radio. That's in Urbana. We're also heard online simultaneously at will.illinois.edu/AM. If you missed part of this program or would like to hear other programs that are archived, there are at that website, will.illinois.edu/keepinthefaith. And you can hear that at your convenience. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with three recent visitors to the Holy Land, Elizabeth Abraham and David McWilliams and John Sutherland, who were there last October and November. And we'll be talking about, for example, what it's like to be in the Holy Land, seeing these ancient Jewish and Christian sites. Sobe will be our guest. Laura Kakoma is her name locally. She grew up in Champaign-Urbana, and she's now a very well-known artist around the world, living in New York. We'll be talking with her by phone on Sunday, May 1st. That's SOMI, about her African-influenced music and the spirituality involved. On May 8th, another New York musician, although he's in New Orleans this week, and we'll be talking to him by phone on May 8th. He'll still be in New Orleans playing with his group Double Wide. That's John Ellis, who plays various saxophones, and we'll be talking about his music and religious, spiritual influences and results from his music. I've been using his tenor sax from an early CD of his as the opening and closing of this show for 12 years now. So it'll be interesting to talk for the first time with this musician on Keeping the Faith. That'll be May 8th. Well, let's get back to our guest today, Wayne Pittard. Wayne, tell us where you grew up.
I grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee. Got my undergraduate degree at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. Then went to Harvard University, where I got my PhD in 1982.
And your specialty was?
Ancient Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations with focus on Hebrew Bible.
And you studied with?
Frank Moore Cross was my dissertation advisor.
Who else was in that distinguished department at that time?
Tom Lambden, the great linguist, Semitic linguist, was there. William L. Moran, the great Assyriologist, was there. Michael Coogan, who anyone out there who has the New Oxford Annotated Bible, third or fourth editions, will notice that he's the editor of that. Was one of my teachers. It was a very good time to be there.
And where did you go after Harvard?
I went to here.
Directly.
This was my first actual job, and have been here ever since.
And you've stayed at the University of Illinois ever since. Now in your years as director of the Spurlock Museum, tell us about some of the other parts of the museum that the people who are interested in various world religions would appreciate.
Okay. When you invited me to come on here, I started thinking about, you know, what I would be able to talk about in terms of religion at the Spurlock. And I realized that I there are just huge numbers of things. The fact is that Spurlock is a museum of world cultures and cultures around the world. Religion is one of the foundational elements of all cultures. And so whichever gallery you go into, and we have six galleries. We have a central core gallery that talks about the universal aspects of human existence. Our theme is a quotation from Confucius in which he said, "By nature, people are nearly alike. By practice, they become different." So our central core celebrates the common humanity of all cultures. And then our five other galleries celebrate the uniquenesses of each culture that their own practices have developed. You go into any of the five galleries and you will find religion playing an extraordinarily important role in every one. So, for example, for ancient cultures, and we have things from ancient to contemporary cultures, we've already talked a little bit about from Mesopotamia. Our materials there talk not just about the gods, but also about the concept of divine kingship, which appeared in Mesopotamia for a while. We have a huge collection of ancient Mesopotamian clay tablets, which include things like medical texts. But medical texts were religious texts because the way you got rid of diseases was you spoke incantations to the gods.
Uh-huh.
So we have on display a medical text that is an incantation to the daughters of the sky god Anu, to heal any of 17 different diseases. In our centennial exhibit, we have a special exhibit about our centennial. You can find a plaque from northern Iraq from about 800 BC that has a character stamped on it and two inscriptions. This was placed under the doorway of your house, and one inscription says, "Go away, evil spirit," and the other inscription says, "Come in, good spirit." And that was a way, a religious way of trying to keep evil spirits out of the house and invite the good ones in.
Which continues to be a contemporary problem.
That's true. That's true. So for Mesopotamia, many of the things we have deal with that. We have an Egypt exhibit. And
including a mummy.
That's correct. Life after death was a major aspect of what the Egyptians were concerned about. And we have things that talk about that. We have an Egyptian sarcophagus. We have two mummy masks, one in the permanent gallery and one in our centennial exhibit. And we have our mummy. It's the mummy of a child, 7 to 9 year old child.
Which you recently took to a hospital. Why?
That's correct. We took the mummy about 2 weeks ago to Carle Foundation Hospital, where they graciously CAT scanned it with their very, very advanced CAT scanner. And we have forensic anthropologists, one from the Smithsonian and people from here, who are going to try to tell us as much as they can about the child. We'll have a symposium about that in November, and so I think people will hear more about the results in the future. But we also have a gallery about ancient Mediterranean civilizations, ancient Greece and Rome, where you will find statues of the Greek gods, Apollo, Artemis, and where we have an astonishing plaster cast of the frieze around the interior, the building of the Parthenon, the temple itself. A frieze cast that was taken from molds that were made in 1787 before the frieze was seriously damaged. And so our frieze preserves sections of our cast preserve parts of the frieze that no longer exist on the original marbles.
Yeah. And because this is a cast, these are life size.
That's right.
These are actual size, and they're
Correct.
They're up where they can't be touched, but they can be seen so clearly.
That's right. That's right. And and that deals with a major Athenian celebration. And so you can see and understand the frieze. Then you can go sort of inside our temple area and see casts of the statues of Athena, who was worshipped inside the Parthenon. We also have things that are more directly related to biblical religion. We have a brick that has an inscription of King Nebuchadrezzar of Babylon, who plays a big role in the Hebrew Bible. Destroyer of Jerusalem, also famous elsewhere for the great Hanging Gardens of Babylon, but plays an important part in the theology of Jeremiah, and plays a role in Daniel and other books. We have, and this is an amazing thing, we have a set of 29 papyri from the Egyptian town of Oxyrhynchus that includes a fragment of the New Testament letter of James, which is, in fact, the earliest surviving fragment of the letter of James in existence. It dates to the early 3rd century. It is one of the 20 or so oldest fragments of the New Testament in existence anywhere. And
this is on display that people could see.
That's right. This is on display up in our early writing case on the second floor in the ancient Near East gallery. We have a spectacular Torah scroll from the late 15th, early 16th century that gives you a beautiful view of a Hebrew text of the Torah.
For our Jewish listeners who are been celebrating Passover, this is would be a wonderful thing to visit.
It
to,
is
to see in that little bit of history. And for Christian listeners who are looking forward to Holy Week and Easter, you have a number of things which can be seen. This fragment from the Book of James, but also, of course, you call it a cast of the Michelangelo Pietà?
That is true. We do. We have two Pietas. We have a plaster cast of the Michelangelo Pietà, which you can compare to a much more medieval but contemporary Pietà from Germany. It's an original piece, and you can see why Michelangelo made such a big splash in terms of the changing ways in which people were being depicted, and the changing ways that Jesus and Mary were being depicted as the church comes out of medieval times into the Renaissance.
We're down to our last 15 or 16 minutes of our program today with Wayne Pichard. Let me give the phone numbers again for listeners who may want to make ask a question or make a comment. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, 1-800-222-9455 if it's a long-distance call. And that's true also if you're listening at will.illinois.edu. Happy to have you join this conversation, as always, here on Keeping the Faith. And I see we do have a caller waiting on line number two. Go ahead, please. Yes.
Hi, this is a delightful program. I've really enjoyed it so far. I wonder if Dr. Pichard could make another couple comments about the seal scrolls. You mentioned that these can go back 5,000 years, and that's to the beginning of writing. It seems really remarkable that they were developing movable type at the time. Did they ever develop that technology any farther than rolling these cylinders? Did they ever develop a way of combining them or using them for what we would think of as printing?
To an extent. To a very limited extent, they did. I mentioned that we've got this brick from Nebuchadrezzar, King Nebuchadrezzar from about 570 BCE. That brick was actually made by a stamp that was carved backwards. So that, you know, sort of in a mirror image, so that they could hit it into the clay and form an inscription that looked right, you know, that had everything going the right direction. And that sort of is type, but it's not really movable. You know, they would big things, and they never got larger, you know, than, 6 or 7 inches square and such.
And we have another caller who didn't want to go on the air but ask our question, which our engineer has given me by computer here. How is it that Moses came to be portrayed in art with horns on his head?
That's a misunderstanding of a passage in the Bible. It's a misreading of a passage in the Bible. And that's actually supposed to be sort of light shining from his face rather than horns. But got confused, became part of the tradition in the Middle Ages and still with us occasionally.
And the people can see that horned, one of the horned Moseses, the Michelangelo did in Rome, if you visit Rome in one of the more obscure churches, but it's worth a trip to see. But for 1,000 years, the Vulgate depicted, reported that in that part of, I guess that's Exodus, when Moses came down the mountain with the tablets, his head was horned. But eventually the Hebrew scholars figured out that rather obscure word really meant his face was shining. So, but that's why that shows up in art, a very interesting bit of history. And we can't really blame St. Jerome. He did the best he could with what he knew at the time.
That's true. Yeah.
Well, let's get back to Wayne Pitchard telling us some more of the just the real treasures in this museum that have deal with religion and spirituality. Oh, by the way, are they insured?
yes, they are insured. Yeah, okay. we have an insurance policy along with Krannert and other parts of the university to.
But of course, you also have to have security. You also have to have this wonderful building to show them safely and displays where they can be seen, but not.
That's right.
Destroyed or stolen.
In fact, you know, if they were destroyed and stolen, they're not replaceable.
Of course,
you can't go out to Scrolls R Us and get a replacement James fragment from the third century and such. But we, I've been talking about the area that I know best, which is ancient Near East and the biblical stuff. But we have two areas in the museum that talk about Islam. It's discussed both in the European Gallery and in the Asia Gallery because people are often not aware of the fact that the largest Muslim country in the world is actually Indonesia in the islands off Southeast Asia. So we talk about Islam in Asia as well as in Europe, where we talk about the three monotheistic religions together. They are Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But you go into the Americas Gallery and all of life in Native American cultures is seen through the religious lens, and that is visible in the way that we have set up our exhibits there. We talk about North American creation stories. We have some casino dolls that are depictions of spirits in Hopi culture that are a very important part of their spiritual life. We talk about ceremonies of various and sundry tribes throughout. Our collection happens to cover the Northern Plains Indians really quite well. And so we have a lot of things there. Same thing with South America. We deal extensively with traditional religions there. We have shaman paraphernalia that people can look at and read about and understand how the shaman's stool is used and the sacred stones and the use of the images of anacondas and turtles throughout the culture, not just in explicitly religious items, but in everyday items as well. Our Asian gallery has exhibits about the traditional religions of the islands of Papua New Guinea and Bali. We have ceremonial masks and shields and drums that are related to ancestor veneration ceremonies in Papua New Guinea. We have from Bali a huge 13 or 14 foot long depiction of Barong Ket, the spirit lion that fights the forces of evil, represented by Rangda, the queen of the witches. A mask of which we have in our centennial exhibit so that you can see both of the characters from Bali.
Let me interrupt just for a moment because that reminds me of when you gave me a very wonderful tour through the museum showing me some of these things, I was struck by their beauty. Mm-hmm. So many of them are just absolutely gorgeous, stunning. Mm-hmm. The colors, the shapes, the patterns. And people who appreciate good art can appreciate the, since this is world culture and much of not only religion, but is expressed in marvelous art, which you have in this within the walls of Spurlock Museum. And I might just mention that with the Cranford Art Museum here at the university closing this summer for extensive building repairs for 2 or 3 months, Spurlock is a wonderful alternative as a place to go just to see some fascinating art.
That's right. The finest of artistic expression in many, many cases has come out as religious expression. And so there is a very thin line between art and religion.
And that dragon you described that's suspended from the ceiling at one point that's, what, 16 feet long, you just said?
Yeah.
It's just knocks you out.
Yeah, it really is quite striking.
But go on with some of the other things that people can discover as they turn a corner in Spurlock Museum.
And that's exactly what happens. You turn the corner in the Asian Oceania Gallery, where we have the Papua New Guinea and Bali materials, and you're in East Asia. And there you see a great deal about Buddhism. We have Buddha statues from Thailand that are quite beautiful. We have a wonderful collection, the Fred Freund collection of carved wooden statues that depict not just the Buddha, but other saints and other traditional characters within Buddhist thought. We have traditional monk clothing. We have texts written on palm leaves, things like that. I might mention that we will have a special exhibit of the Freund collection of wood carvings in the lobby of the museum between July of this year and January. That's in addition to our centennial exhibit, which is really, really spectacular in itself. So both of those exhibits will be running during the second half of this year.
When is the museum open for visitors?
It is open Wednesday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturday, 10 to 4, Sunday, 12 to 4, and closed on Monday and open on Tuesday, 12 to 5. It's kind of a complicated schedule, but...
And you have a website for people who wish to find the details?
We do, and... It is www.spurlock.uiuc.edu.
And Spurlock is spelled
S-P-U-R-L-O-C-K. That's correct.
So give that again. Spurlock?
Spurlock.uiuc.edu.
Great. And if people want to phone, do you have the phone number? Well, here I found it. It's 333-2360.
That's it.
People call you. You don't call yourself.
That's right.
Yeah. That's 217-333-2360.
That's correct. Yep.
Now, you do a lot of educational programs, particularly for children in school, K through 12. Tell us a little bit about what some of those opportunities there are. We probably have many
That's
teachers
true.
Listening throughout the yep. Central Illinois and Central Indiana region who might like to come to the Spurlock Museum of World Cultures.
That's right. We do. We have a spectacular education section. We service about 11,000 students from K to 12 every year in programs at the museum itself, but we also send our people out to schools, both in preparation for trips to the museum and also in programs that are specifically designed for schools that don't have the money to get their students to the museum. We have field trips that come from as far north as Glen Ellen and Aurora, Illinois, in the Chicago suburbs, and as far south as Charleston, Mattoon. All across central and northern Illinois, people come to us. And we just have a number of really, really good programs. So teachers who are interested should contact us and talk to the education program. I should mention before we leave that we also have a bunch of good stuff about Africa, African religion as well. That was the last
you hadn't got to that gallery yet when I interviewed when I interrupted you. Yes.
Yep. So we actually do have important religious materials talking about cultures of all the major continents except for Antarctica. Which doesn't have much religious cultural tradition because there aren't people living in Antarctica.
Now, tell us about the value of the Spurlock Museum for students, university students here in Illinois.
The collection
Many
here—
Many professors bring classes.
They do. We have about 50 classes that come in every year from university courses. And everything from classics department and history department and religion department, but also nursing and other groups that want to remind their students that people who come from other countries are people too. And you know, this is a very important thing that we are trying to get across to all those elementary students and such. But it's also a good thing to remind our university students that because someone speaks a different language, has different ideas about how things work, that doesn't make them any less human. And in fact, you can learn a lot from people with different practices.
I'm afraid we're out of time with our guest today, Wayne Pittard, who is a professor in the Department of Religion here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, was named a university scholar early in his career, has been here ever since world culture here at the university. Let me give the hours again. Wednesday through Friday, it's open from 9 to 5, Saturday 10 to 4, Sunday 12 to 4, Tuesday 12 to 5. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. And next week we'll be talking with some people who have just come back last November from a tour of the Holy Land, Elizabeth Abraham, David McWilliams, and John Sutherland. That will be next week on Easter Sunday at 5 till 6 p.m. here on WILL. The following week, our guest will be a musician, Somi, and we'll be hearing some of her African-influenced music, and then John Ellis, tenor saxophone, with his group Double Wide. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
You listen to WILL every day because you find something here that appeals to you. Whether you tune in for Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Focus, or the Daily Agricultural Markets, WILL brings you the programs you enjoy throughout your day. It's radio that appeals to your love of learning, your desire for information. This is our Spring Pledge Week at WILL. Your contribution helps support these programs. Please take a moment now and make a contribution online at willpledge.org.
The 2011 Vintage Vinyl Sale is Saturday, April 30th at the former Altman's Billiard and Barstool Supply, located at 301 West Market View Drive, Champaign. And starting April 4th, we'll accept used records, CDs, DVDs, and working stereo equipment at the sale site. Call me, Dean Geiken, at 217-333-6503 for more information.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana. As a